consistently, when you set a goal, when you set a target, they win. I've also seen people who, no matter what goals or targets they set, they just lose. So for me, it's setting a pattern of wins and successes. You watch them grow over time towards their goals, and goals shift and change, but you see people who expand and people who contract.
Sure.
And I think success for me is being one of those people who consistently win and consistently expand, regardless of the environment they're in.
Your network is your net worth. Come listen to some of the most successful people I know share invaluable knowledge, stories, and advice in real estate, business, and beyond. This is Weiss Advice. Whether you want to take your business or personal life to the next level, look no further.
Welcome back to another episode of Weiss Advice. I am your host, Yona Weiss, excited to be here on another beautiful day with a podcast for you all to listen to with some amazing guests. When I say guests, because we have a dynamic duo today, Christian Osgood and Cody Davis, who apparently are crushing it in the real estate space. I just heard of you guys recently from a good friend, Terrence Doyle, who had you on the Multifamily Mentors Season 3, which I'm excited to see that. Definitely my favorite podcast out there. And so I'm looking forward to hear about you. And I also heard you on the Cody on the Bigger Pockets podcast most recently. Really crushing it at such a young age. Excited to have you guys on the show. First off, how you doing? What's going on?
Thanks for having us. We appreciate you having us on and excited to chat with you.
Awesome. Well, it's really exciting for me to have such young people doing amazing things in real estate. Why don't you give our listeners a little bit of a background, who you are, how you got started, and maybe, you know, what you're up to right now.
All right, Cody, kick us off.
I can do that. So Christian and I are now a duo. We started that adventure about a year and a half ago now. However, I've been in the space for a little over 3 years. I got started as a college dropout. I ended up getting my real estate license. Some guy on Facebook told me to drop out of college and get my license. So I did what any rational teenager would do. And I did that. Never met him before until that moment. So I thought, you know, this guy knows it all and I'll jump into it. Ended up not selling any real estate for a while because I had no clients, no family or friends in the business, and found a way to buy a 12-plex seller finance just 9 months later from the start of that, zero money out of pocket. And you know, fast forward 3.5 years, I'm at 108 rental apartments and a resort. I own most of it today with Christian. And yeah, we're wheeling and dealing, seller finance.
Okay. So that's anything you want to add to that, Christian? Where you got started? How you guys partnered up? Because I do want to unpack some of the things you mentioned there, Cody, but I'd love to hear that part first.
Yeah. Well, Cody started in 19, just diving straight in. I started at 28. I mean, technically I've house hacked a condo before that, but I don't really count that. I started the multifamily investing journey at 28. COVID hit. I'd wanted to be a real estate investor for a long time. And what I kept doing was adding steps. I went from selling apparel to working at land.com, which got bought by CoStar, who's loopnetapartments.com, that whole network. I worked for them for years and I was in real estate without owning real estate. I was on the wrong end of the table. I was around the time that the whole world shut down for the whole COVID deal, where I was like, okay, well, I'm going to go do something else. I'm an outside sales rep and I can't go outside, or at least I'm not allowed to. So what are we going to do now? And so I bought a duplex. Then shortly after, I was like, wow, I love this buying multifamily thing. Cody said I should buy a duplex across the street from his sixplex. And so I picked that up and that ended up being a fantastic property. That was 101% financed with hard money. And the next deal that we did was the 38-plex together. So once I entered Moses Lake and started working with Cody across the street from his building, we were working together all the time. And I had had this goal of, hey, I want to hit 30 units by 30. Problem is, I just turned 29 by that time. And Cody's like, well, I can't help you because the deal that I want to buy, I need a partner on, and it's 38 units. I can get you to 42. I can't help you with 30. And that's, we've gone about that fast ever since.
I was over here just wondering. I was like, okay, this guy's at 4. He wants to get to 30 units. And I was at 30 units already at that age. So I was like, well, there's only one deal I know of that this could happen on. And if we're going to do it, it's going to be this one. So I walked into his office and he said, yes. So we did it.
That's so cool. So how did you guys meet? Where did that part of the story fit in? Because I missed that.
We worked at a real estate brokerage. And this was the one that I got started at.
Okay.
They've since self-imploded due to bad management.
Yikes.
However, yeah. However, Christian ran up the call center. He got it profitable. And I was just a real estate agent trying to figure my way about. And I'd figured out the real estate acquisition side, how to buy apartments without banks and without sponsors and without syndicating or crowdsourcing. And so I usually would just sneak into his office. I wasn't supposed to, but I wanted to see how he was doing the call center thing because I didn't know. And I wasn't doing much brokerage activity. So we started hanging out and that happened.
Wow. That's pretty cool. So, okay, I want to back up because we talked about, you kind of dropped some terms over there that maybe our listeners aren't so familiar with and figure out, wait a second, how does someone who doesn't have any experience buying apartments, well, go ahead and buy an apartment complex or a resort without any money out of pocket or with little money out of pocket without, you know, you talked about this seller financing. We've talked about it a couple of times in the show, but I'd love for you to kind of unpack, describe what that is, first of all, and then second of all, how did you have the, courage, I'll use a nice PG word there, to go ahead and do that on your first deal?
Yeah, well, to unpack the seller finance space, there's debt markets and equity markets. There's some, if you think about it, there's some markets that are more like the Dave Ramsey approach, and some markets are more like Robert Kiyosaki, where people just borrow till they drop. I'm more inclined to do the debt-free route. The problem is I don't have any money, so I had to borrow a lot of money. And so I was buying stuff 100% LTV. And it wasn't real. And I was told this by my mentor at the time. He's like, you're not going to get a bank loan. I thought I was going to get a bank loan. I thought I was different. Every time I talked to a lender, they're like, you don't have the net worth. You don't have the cash flow. Your global cash flow's bad. And so I was like, okay. So in the beginning, the seller finance route really popped up for me when someone in the office had a client who was working on it. But what it is it's in an equity market where people don't have a ton of debt. There are markets in the United States where there's just less debt on the assets. And there's this due on sale clause on most debt obligations, most loans that say, if you sell, you have to pay this off. And if people owe a lot of money, you have to pay off their debt in order for them to sell it with clear title. So the seller finance route, if they don't have any debt on it, they can do whatever they want. They don't have any special clauses, any contingencies with some other lender. They can take payments over time. And so what I learned was you can do what's called a promissory note and deed of trust with the seller instead of a bank. Mm-hmm. Your promissory notes, your promise to pay them. And the deed of trust says they trust you're going to pay them. But if you don't, they're going to keep a lien on title to protect themselves. And so I can structure any debt I want, negotiate any interest rate, any term. And the very first deal, it was a partnership of three. And two of the partners weren't pulling any weight anymore. So they wanted to liquidate, and they being the one that was doing all the work. So they accepted 10% down, seller financed, 30-year AM, no balloon. And so I just got a 30-year term, fixed rate, 6%, 10% down. And that was a cool debt product that's not usually available on commercial assets.
Yeah.
And I was able to use that in the kind of loan to own model. I didn't know what it was in the beginning, but someone gave me a second lien for the 10%, just another investor of a broker in the office. And they're like, well, if the kid fails, I'll just take over this cool fixed rate product and you can't get this loan again.
That's crazy. That's awesome. I love the creativity that it brings also, because, you know, when you're going to banks and trying to finance it, yeah, you're absolutely right. They're going to be looking at your liquidity, you know, looking at your net worth. Going to be looking at so many things. Also experience. Have you done this before? Can you sign on this loan? You know, without having to bring in a cosigner, it really limits who can buy a piece of commercial real estate. And so here opens up opportunities that you might not ever had.
Yeah. And to this day, I've still never bought anything with a bank loan. I have one bank loan, but that was a refi.
That's pretty cool. Well, that's even better because, you know, they're a commercial bank refinance. They're looking at the income of the property. They're looking at the business. And so as opposed to when you're getting started and you're trying to buy the property outright, they're going to be looking at a lot of other things as well.
And that was really validating. That property we have the bank loan on, that was the first deal Cody and I did together. We bought that, 15% down?
Yeah.
That was a seller finance note, $2 million purchase price. It'd been on the market for 13 years at the same price, and no one else figured out how to do it because it is an ugly, beat up building. It was really validating to actually go through our first year of partnership, buy something creatively, because creatively, to be fair, anyone can buy anything creatively, and you have the potential to do a really bad deal as long as everyone gets it accepted. It's fun to actually see full cycle. We did it. We went through a year. And we got a bank loan done, which means we qualified and the property itself. It just kind of verifies, hey, we actually did a deal and we had some idea of what we were doing on that.
That's extremely validating. And I mean, that's really what's inspiring and so encouraging, and why I love this story and love talking to you guys about this, just hearing it, because it's so encouraging. People think there's so many barriers. Often we kid ourselves and we put these self-limiting beliefs on ourselves that we can't do this. And there's all these barriers to entry. But here, being creative actually allows you to do something that you might not think may be possible.
Yeah. And it just comes down to deal debt equity. I mean, you find a deal you want to buy, you just have to figure out who could give you the loan for it.
Right.
And if they won't give you 100% of it, can you borrow the rest of it? Or do you have to bring in a partner?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just super simple.
Well, I mean, it sounds super simple, but I guess the hardest part, you know, of any real estate deal is finding the deal, right? And this makes it even harder, because not just finding a deal, but you talked about before, finding a deal that the owner owns it, you know, free and clear, or owns it without any debt or a little debt, whatever. And they can be that, do that seller financing, which is not always the case.
Yeah, there are some creative workarounds on that, but it also depends on your approach, because there's more deals out there than there are money or investors with cash. There's so many opportunities. It just depends how investors are going about looking for it. We do a little bit of unorthodox approach, but we don't ask people to sell. It's against the grain on the whole sales idea, because right. We don't ask for the close. We just ask people to teach us how they got to where they're at. And a byproduct of that is they show us exactly how they bought their portfolio. And what better than to repeat their strategy to buy their portfolio? So we learn how they played the game. And whether we buy their stuff or not, now we know how to play the game a little bit differently than everybody's talking about it online. Because most of these people, and some of them have been playing the game for 5 decades, and they know a thing or two about a thing or two. And so we've been able to repeat their strategy over and over.
So this really brings me to another point. And Christian, I want to hear from you in a second, but maybe you can add on to this about just finding those mentors, finding those people who have done this before. And that's really the key. It sounds like this is really what has led you to where you've been, is just finding those right people and being blessed to have them in your network and having them willing to teach you or to share with you or to kind of shadow them, if you will.
Yeah, well, I think this is where we get to play in a different arena, because we're doing creative finance and the terms, the interest rate, the price, they're all made up. The nice thing with that is you get to be relationship based. If you are a traditional buyer, typically you have to negotiate on price, because I'm going to call the traditional box, you're getting bank debt, which means you have to go through an appraisal, which means you have to get your price. There's no other way to do it. Since we don't care about price, because we buy things on two principles, how do we buy it? How do we never lose it? We're buy and hold. I don't need to exit the property. If I have a balloon, I may need to refinance. So I just need to answer the basic questions of, you know, what does it look like today? Can we buy it where it cash flows on long-term fixed rate debt? And if there's a balloon, conservatively, what do we look at that balloon to adjust the financing? Answer those questions, we're golden. It's very simple. The fun part of finding the deals now is, while everyone else is looking for distressed sellers, out-of-state sellers, they're looking for something to buy, we're looking for people who have already mastered the game, who we can learn from. And those people who own a lot of real estate for a long period of time, they tend to roll down the debt and have less debt on their products, which means we get to do a lot more creative financing, because we get to avoid banks with people who have already, quote-unquote, won the real estate game.
Mm-hmm. And they're probably much more open to it. I mean, obviously, you have companies and you have syndicators, and that's really a big chunk of, you know, what we hear about. But in the end of the day, there are tons of people who have, like you said, played the real estate game for decades, have been doing this, have been successful, gone through cycles, and understand debt markets and understand what it's like getting started. Like I said, just to reiterate that, I think it's amazing you'd be able to capitalize on that and find that. So, I mean, really, the question I have for you is, how do you find these people in the first place?
Yeah. So what I've found to be true is that there's a map online that has every single property you could ever want to buy from. And it's Google Maps. And some people laugh at me when I say that, but it's true. Every property that you could want to buy is on Google Maps. And so I find the big roofs, because they're more likely to be apartment buildings. And now my objective, I was sitting down with someone over coffee in Federal Way. They're like, I can't find any deals. I'm like, look across the street. You just have to figure out who owns it and how do I contact them? And then when they actually pick up the phone, how do you get to coffee? Because you're not going to learn anything of value over the phone call. You have to put a face to the name, and vice versa. You got to put your face and your name just in front of them. So I always try and book a coffee meeting. And Christian and I have done that over and over. I've done it. He's taken the strategy and done it. We primarily did it in Moses Lake And we're working on doing that over in Quincy because just Grant County in general is a great rental market. But
which state is this?
Washington.
You're in the state of Washington. Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, obviously focusing on local markets is the easiest way to go because you can meet local landlords. You can meet people who are there in person.
And it's one way to go.
Market's about, it's a 3-hour drive over the mountains from us. I mean, it's in our backyard-ish, like we can get there in a day, but it's definitely out of market investing. And we have a couple guys in our mentorship group, Caleb and Chuck, they live in San Diego. They could not find the deal there. They're investing in Texas and they've picked up in the last few months, they've picked up 28 seller financed units.
At 19.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
The big thing for me though, is that you choose your market and you stick to that market, whether it's in your backyard or not. It is a hyper local strategy. Become the guy in your market.
Yeah. And that's a recurring theme on this podcast. Also, you know, the recurring theme is just be focused and focus on a market, pick a market and focus on one thing you're good at. I think it's awesome that you guys have just chosen this path. Do you see this continuing? I mean, how big can you kind of scale this business at this point? Or how much do you see it?
So the ability to scale is limited by the ability to get new debt that cash flows. And that's it. So we found bigger deals. I mean, there was a seller finance deal that we were looking at out of state for a while. It was 20% down. The down payment was like $7.5 million. And we could probably find a way to JV that. However, we can take it up to the 300-400 unit complexes. It's just a function of stabilizing our current existence because we have a principle-based approach and we don't violate our principles and we're not willing to scale at the cost of what we've built. Because when we first partnered a year and a half ago now, it took us 1 year to hit Christian's goals, which were to retire his wife so she could do what she wanted. And now she does that.
That's awesome.
And I'm in a place now where I figure out my tax stuff and then I get to hit my goal of being able to take care of my mom so she can do whatever she wants. I just have to figure out gift tax. But we did all that we wanted to do in a year. And we thought it was going to take 2 years, but we got there and we don't want to jeopardize what we've built just to scale. However, we've done the math and we will scale to the $1 billion mark before I'm 40. And I see a lot of it being through doing the aggressive seller financing and then using all the cash flow to pay it down in blocks.
That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, having a goal, I think that's really important. And being able to meet those goals and hit those goals in such a short amount of time really kind of just raises the bar and see, well, what else? What next? And just creating or figuring out other things that you can do. And what I've found from a lot of people in similar situations are, you know, really figuring out how can I give back or what can I do to live a more fulfilled life, whatever that is. And everyone has their own way to do it. But I'm curious to know, I mean, obviously retiring your wife so she can, that's awesome, you know, being able to do that. And then retiring your mother, being able to help and build a family. I mean, these are really awesome goals if they are yours. But what else? Are there any other things, any other ways that you guys like to give back?
Well, the fun thing with hitting goals is you get to set new goals. Like my first thing for me was I'm like, I hate working for other people because I got burned by an unusual amount of employers and partners, and Cody got like massively burned by one or two. And so working for people was the big thing for me where I'm like, okay, I want to get out of that. I want to be able to provide for myself, which we got to. And then the next big thing was, okay, my wife also doesn't love her job. Let's get her retired. Once we hit that, the biggest thing that we do to give back is I love teaching and talking about real estate. Like this is my favorite game. It plays a lot like a board game and I'm a board game nerd. So I just love playing this. And so we started a little mentorship group. We have an online course. It's on themultifamilystrategy.com. But like, I just pour myself into that group because it's fun to watch 19-year-olds. Like what Cody did is amazing. It's fun watching other teenagers look at what Cody did between 19 and 22 and do what he did even faster using the same strategies. When we can save other people some pain, it is the most rewarding thing that we do, hands down.
And for me, I coached gymnastics for 4 years and I did parkour since I was like 9 and a half. And so I'm huge into fitness. And I think that there is, just like there's a gap in wealth inequality, there's also getting to be a bigger gap of in shape versus out of shape in individuals in the youth. And so as a gymnastics coach, I was huge on, you know, strengthening your body for actual function, not just for how you look. It's not form over function, but the other way around. And right. So I want to be able to coach again. And I like to be able to donate back to provide programs for kids for that, because that's a issue that I see increasing, not decreasing, as far as severity in the coming years.
Awesome. Love to hear that. And going back to what Christian was saying, just the board game aspect of real estate, it's so true. It really is. But a lot of us have like this imposter syndrome where, have you guys dealt with this at all? And how have you overcome this? Because this is really, really common, especially with people starting out. I know, Christian, you said you were kind of, before you got started, setting all these steps along the way, but you know, dealing with the fact that, okay, I'm this young person, I'm doing this deal. How is the seller even going to, you know, trust me or believe that I can do this?
I think for, at least for me, and Cody, I'll have you answer this too, because you did this at 19, which I think is a lot more impressive. But for me, I found that once I got that first deal done, because that was the hard part, was just like, I have to get through the first deal. I had the realization, I think it was during a Cardone video of all things, but I had the realization that I'm like, okay, if I want to be a real estate investor, I have to invest in real estate.
Right.
And it took the whole world shutting down for a little while for me to get to a point where I'm like, you know what? There's only one way to do this. I'm going to go ahead. I'm just going to buy a duplex. It's not even that big of a step. I bought it very low down, and getting that done, I went like, it's like, oh my gosh, I can close this. Did another duplex that had, it was a little bit more renovation heavy. I'm like, okay, I can do that. When Cody brought up the 38-plex and we decided to take that out together and the project, we bought it for $2 million. It appraised for 3.4 once we stabilized it in 9 months.
Right.
I mean, those type of wins just continue to build confidence. I'm like, I can take out a 38 unit just as well as I can a duplex.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the things you have to do. But the hardest piece, at least for me, was eliminating all the steps to build up there and go, if I want to be an investor, I have to invest. If I want multifamily, there's no other way to do it than to buy a multifamily building. And that's as simple as it is.
Well, it sounds simple. But for a lot of people, no, but for a lot of people, it's not. For a lot of people, they have that like, well, how am I going to actually do that? Like learning the steps. And sure, you can spend years learning that and get stuck in the analysis paralysis, but you got to take that step. So good for you for just literally taking that step and taking that jump to buy that duplex and seeing that it's possible. And then I think that kind of burst the bubble, like, okay, well, this is not a big deal. It's not really a big deal. Let's do more of it.
Mm-hmm.
And what about you, Cody?
Well, in the beginning, I had a real estate agent in the office. He was the owner of the firm, and he sat me down and told me that there was a lot of things I didn't know that I didn't know. And I think that is the overarching message for people. I didn't know anything. I thought I knew everything. And so there was a big learning curve. However, the fact that I didn't know a lot about the business made it really easy to move forward. Because when I saw a 12-plex, I didn't understand that the down payment had to actually come from somebody's bank account. I thought when someone placed a lien, I thought they just placed a lien against the asset. I didn't realize money had to actually transfer. And so there was just so many things. And then I had to botch a whole bunch of pitches. And I didn't really understand really anything about the business. But I understood that that was the next step. And even if I was a little bit nervous at times, my hand was shaking when I ended up signing for the $1 million debt. It was $1.1 million debt on my first deal.
Wow.
It was still the right thing to do. Like, that wasn't a reason not to do it. And that is really what pushed me forward. Imposter syndrome was huge. Then I had a 12-plex, and it didn't really hit me till 3 months after I bought it, because I was mowing the lawn, couldn't afford lawn care. So I was mowing the lawn. I look at the building. I've got three buildings, three fourplexes, one lot, two of them are bricks. And I looked at the bricks. I'm like, those are my bricks. And it finally hit. And I was like, oh, I bought a building. And then 6 months after that, I bought another 12-plex. And I was a little more comfortable buying the second one, except for the second one was half the price and a total dump. And like it just needed so much work. And since then, I've done a lot of that work, but I started finding new problems that I had to solve for. And they were bite-sized at that point. And while it was 12 units, it was really more income than a single family. So I thought it had less risk, more income, more expenses, but it had more cash flow.
Right.
And that made me feel comfortable doing it.
There's so much to learn. I mean, and it's amazing that you've done that. One thing that I'm curious about, you mentioned earlier that you did, or you've done all this, you've bought these properties without taking on or raising money from investors, correct? You kind of dropped it in there, but at the same time, you also mentioned you had some private money loans coming in that maybe they have a lien on the property, maybe not. I didn't catch that. Maybe, can you elaborate on those two points a little?
Yeah. So we haven't had to go out and crowdsource for big funds. We haven't done funds. Just doesn't pique my interest. I don't like all the regulations. I don't like all the reporting. I like keeping things super simple. And we have a big rule, don't add steps. And we see funds as adding steps. So we've done a couple JVs And the bulk of my business from 0 to 30 units, granted, this is before Christian and I ever did anything together, I bought the 30 apartments and I just did first lien, second lien every time. Got the seller to finance a first. The highest amount I ever got someone to finance was 90%. And the lowest was 75% on the first 30 units. And that was it. The first JV I ever did for actually bringing in money, like someone writes a check and then they get equity, was on the 38-plex with Christian. We bought that. It was $300,000 down. We bought it with zero money down. We fronted the renovations. I did a flip. It's the only property I've ever sold. And it would have made more money if I kept it. But, you know, that's why we have our principals today. But that we started doing a couple of JVs. And if we do a JV, we have something called a buyout agreement so that we can get all the equity back in the future. Mm. We appreciate people giving us their money. We'll pick up a 1.5 or double on their money for a buyout agreement, but we're not going to partner with them forever. And that's something that's really important to us because people add risk.
Sure. Absolutely. And having those kind of second positions also a little more risky as well. But at the same time, you're able to get deals done in these creative ways.
And I found that for a lot of people, as a JV, even with a buyout, it's structured a lot like debt, right? You have a fixed point in time that you're paying them out at a fixed price. And I hate variables. So that, like, if you want to make creative finance easy, figure out how to keep as many things constant as humanly possible. Fixed rate debt, fixed buyouts, fixed timelines. It's easy to plan for things that you know are happening and can budget for.
Absolutely.
Variables are bad. But as we're doing these, I found that on a JV structure, like some of these you can raise as debt. There's a couple advantages to bringing on an equity partner. One, if you pick up a property with huge upside that doesn't have a ton of day one cash flow, but you have a very clear plan of how you're getting it there, you don't have fixed payments that you're trying to make. You don't bleed on a property that doesn't make money, which is extremely important.
Sure.
But I think beyond that, it is just psychologically different for someone to be like, hey, I'm going to lend on a property versus, hey, I'm actually on the LLC. I'm going to be part of this adventure with you. Even if there is a buyout, I am an owner with this. And there's some tax benefits to that. But I think it's more than anything, I want to do this project with you, and giving equity to one equity partner on a deal with a fixed buyout is a fantastic way to make someone comfortable and bring them in on a deal with you.
Yeah, that's smart. I think you're probably right. There's a lot of psychology to it from the lender or investor side of things, very different than, you know, just asking for a loan, getting a lien on the property per se. But that's amazing. I mean, just so many things to unpack. I would love to kind of just hash out a lot of other things that we've discussed until this point. And we could really go on forever, but I do like to keep this podcast to a half an hour for our listeners. So with that said, let's jump into what we call the final four. I'm going to ask, I've done this in the past where we've done the newlywed game where I ask each of you and then the other one goes out, but I'm not going to do that because you guys aren't in the same room, whatever. Also, I think it's more fun this to not do that. So we'll just ask you guys individually and I'll just go back and forth. First question is, what is the worst job you ever had? Cody, let's start with you.
Yeah, I had a Safeway job for 27 minutes. That was the smallest paycheck I've ever seen. But I walked in, I was going to go get an extra job when I was not a super great real estate agent, and I was going to work night shifts. That would have been a terrible mistake. And I realized that after I worked there for 27 minutes, so I left. So my odds of getting a real job again are slim to none because I didn't give my 2 weeks. But I walk in, start doing the training, and I was like, this isn't what I want to do anymore. So I leave. And that was the worst job. I did enjoy coaching gymnastics.
That's awesome. I mean, I guess being your worst job, only being there for 27 minutes is not so bad after all.
Could be worse.
Christian, what about you? What was the worst job you ever had?
Right out of college, I had a business venture fail, or actually the head of that group actually just stole all the money and disappeared, which happened with partners. I don't like partnering. Cody's the exception to that, but partners are rough. So coming out of that, I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life and no income, and I needed money. So I actually cleaned screens at a t-shirt screen printing shop. I would make the shirts and clean the actual screens for screen printing for about 6 months while I figured out what I wanted to do with my life. That was awful.
Yeah, sounds like
it. Would not recommend.
A lot of fumes, sounds like.
Oh gosh, it was so bad. And the ventilation was horrible. So you'd use chemicals and you'd pass out. It is the worst.
Oh my goodness. Okay. Second question. What's a book you've read that's giving you a paradigm shift? Oh, let's go back to Cody.
Deals on Wheels by Lonnie Scruggs. I've shared that book many times on different podcasts, but little known book to most. And the few people who read it seem to think is outdated, but that shifted my mindset quite a bit.
Very cool. First I've heard of it. So definitely going to check that out and put that in the show notes for anyone else. What about you, Christian?
Gosh, a little bit cliche, but the 10X book by Cardone. Yeah, well, there you go. Cody has the mug.
All right.
I have varying opinions on Cardone, but his stuff on mindset is, I think it's flawless. I think it is the best book that I've ever read on how to think. I read that book and my takeaway from it was I have permission to be obsessed with what I do because I like to go all in on stuff.
Right.
That gave me the mental, I don't even know what the right word is, but it gave me the permission that I felt I needed to be like, okay, I can leave my job, pursue real estate, and dedicate every waking hour of my life to mastering this game. And I'm super glad I did. So that book changed everything for me.
Awesome. And I totally agree with your assessment of that. My opinion of Grant Cardone himself as a person is not too high, but as a thought leader and his content is just incredible. And that was a book that I read about 4 or 5 years ago and also totally changed the way that I focused on business and was incredible. So definitely highly recommended. Check it out. Put that in the show notes as well. Cody, what is skill or talent that you would like to learn?
It'd be cool to learn how to manage people. I've focused a lot of time on figuring out how to communicate with people, and I've done that a lot with property owners and with investors and companies, but I communicate with them. I can't manage people. And I'm usually very direct, so that doesn't always work with managing people. So that is a skill that I would have to work on.
All right.
Christian's laughing because he knows.
That's how you know.
He's seen the other side.
Right. It's a great one. It's definitely something that can be learned for sure. So, you know, the good news is you're young and you guys are just building this, starting this. But as you do continue to scale, I imagine you will need to take on some of those responsibilities.
Yeah, well, that's some of the great parts of partnership too, is you have other people in your org who have complementing skills.
Right.
The skill that I need to learn is I cannot do the software stuff. It should be intuitive. Everything about my personality type says I should be good at this. And if I have to program anything, figure out how to make anything on the back end, I am a systems-minded person who cannot combine technology with systems.
Wow.
If I could learn basic tech, that would make my entire universe so much more efficient.
I mean, probably just a course on coding or something might be like Python. I don't know. Something like that could be the answer. Who knows? Well, I wish you guys luck with both of those skills. I imagine you'll put them to the test. Final question to you is, what does success mean to you?
Yeah, success for me is being able to see a vision all the way through. And regardless of what that vision is for anybody, it could be financial, it could be spiritual, it could be familial. You know, you pick your vision and then you sit down and you execute on it. I just think as far as all encompassing ideas of success, that is the one for me that says, I'm going to do this. And then I actually make it happen. And for me in the beginning, I'm going to buy some real estate that made it happen. I'm going to be able to be in a financial position to help my mom.
Mm-hmm.
Got there, get back into coaching, that's next, but just be able to sit down and say, I'm gonna throw a dart on the board and it's gonna land right here, and then we make it happen. That is success for me.
Awesome. Beautiful definition. What about you?
Yeah, Cody's is much more elegant than mine. Same vein, but people who are successful, they tend to win very frequently. It doesn't mean they don't have losses, and I think everyone I've ever met who is a winner has sustained phenomenal losses. It's very, very hard not to ever lose. But consistently, when you set a goal, when you set a target, they win. I've also seen people who, no matter what goals or targets they set, they just lose. So for me, it's setting a pattern of wins and successes. You watch them grow over time towards their goals, and goals shift and change, but you see people who expand and people who contract.
Sure.
And I think success for me is being one of those people who consistently win and consistently expand, regardless of the environment they're in.
Love it. That's a great definition. I don't think I've heard it ever, you know, really spun that specific way, but I love it. Really do. Really amazing having you guys on the show. Appreciate you coming on. And where can our listeners find you or reach out to you if they want to?
We have a shared channel on YouTube, Cody and Christian Multifamily Strategy. And we're also on Instagram. Christian got his actual name. So that's cool.
I'm at Christian Osgood. I'm easy to find. And I do respond to my messages there. If you want to message us directly, I am very responsive on that platform.
And then my Instagram, I have a shirt that says I'm Cody doing Cody things. So I figure what better than to do at doing Cody things.
There you go.
So that's how you find me.
Very cool. Well, we'll make sure to put those in the show notes as well, guys. It's been amazing having you. I appreciate you taking the time today and really excited to kind of see where this blossoms. I mean, you said the $1 billion goal before 40. I'm not going to be surprised when it happens. So looking forward to kind of following the journey.
Thank you. 17 years to go.
There we go. We got time.
Awesome. And to our listeners, thank you guys again for joining us all the way to the end. And remember, the best advice comes only when you ask.
Real quick, I have one question for you. Did you like this episode? If you did, I want to ask you a huge favor. See, the biggest thing that helps this podcast grow and that will spread this message to the whole world is that if you leave a review, a rating, and subscribe to the podcast. What that does is it basically tells the platforms that this podcast is out on is that you like my stuff and I'm doing something right. So take a few seconds out of your day, hit that subscribe button, leave a rating or review. I would be extremely grateful. Also, I want to hear from you guys. So I want to hear some feedback. If you have any questions for future episodes, please find me on LinkedIn. Send me a DM, a connection request, Yona Weiss, and I'd love to hear from you.